This is ominous parallels number 9, and this comes from chapter 10 of the book, The Culture of Hatred. An historic group of intellectuals in Weimar Germany, including theorists in the humanities, scientists, novelists, social commentators, journalists, playwrights, artists, professed a deep antipathy to the nation's entrenched dogmas and undertook to offer their countrymen fresh ideas. On the whole, these men were independent of the political, religious, and educational establishments and beholden to no outside power. They were the free spirits of the German Republic. The product of their activities was that blend of art, theory, values, and manners, which observers at the time and ever since have cherished as Weimar culture. Weimar culture, in this sense of the term, does not designate the total of the cultural activities of Weimar Germany, but those highly visible works and trends which rejected the traditional 19th century approaches, each in its own field and self-consciously championed, the new, unorthodox, even the revolutionary. For the most part, these trends antedated the Republic. Despite the vigorous opposition of the imperial regime, Expressionism, for instance, the leading art movement within Weimar culture, had already reached maturity in Germany prior to World War I. After the war, with the conservative forces in disarray, the new trends flourished in every field. Although bitterly controversial, they were passionately acclaimed in avant-garde circles, and they set the dominant tone of the Republic's cultural life. The Weimar vision of the world came to be the pace-setter for other countries of the West. Weimar Germany, in the words of Walter Lequer, was the first truly modern culture. Whereas in France, writes Bernard Myers, the struggle was far from over and in the United States merely beginning. Germany during the 20s seems to have been a paradise for contemporary painters, sculptors, and graphic artists. Per capita, there was more acceptance of contemporary art in Germany during the pre-Hitler period than anywhere else. When we think of Weimar, writes Peter Gay, we think of modernity in art, literature, and thought. This raises the question, what is modernity in art, literature, and thought? A question none of these authors discusses. What is the fundamental impulse defining Weimar culture, the basic principle uniting the work of Kaiser, Kandinsky, and Schoenberg with that of men such as Thomas Mann, Karl Barth, Sigmund Freud, and Werner Heisenberg? And what does this principle do to the people who have to breathe it in daily? What does it do to their souls, their lungs, their sense of hope, and their capacity for hatred? If art is the barometer of a culture, literature, the most explicit of the arts, may be taken as the barometer of art. The two preeminent figures of Weimar literature were Gerhard Hauptmann and Thomas Mann. Both had been famous before the Republic, and both were criticized in certain avant-garde circles as insufficiently modern. Nevertheless, the two men are an eloquent indication of the spirit of the new German culture. One of the two, Hauptmann, was the most widely respected at the time. Although his work was not confined to any one artistic school or literary form, his reputation rested on his activity in the German theater of the 1890s. He was the country's outstanding exponent of naturalism. Hauptmann was dedicated to portraying realistic human characters as dictated by his idea of reality and of human nature. Although his plays typically feature bitter social protest from a Marxist perspective, the characters are not presented as purposeful men. In this regard, The Weavers is representative. Despite their fury at injustice, The Weavers are not efficacious proletarian giants. They are stressedly pawns determined by economic factors, made wretched by social forces beyond any single man's power to cope with. They are worn, self-effacing, little people, brooding, reckless, weak, given to whining complaints and berserk rages and drink and superstition. There is no outstanding figure among these sufferers, no individual to dominate the action. In fact, no developed characterizations at all. The protagonist of The Weavers is not a man but a social class, represented by hordes of interchangeable workers who function only as a mass. As a social determinist, Hauptmann preached that the individual is a pawn of the group. In his own political behavior, he acted accordingly. He never abandoned his fundamental commitment to collectivism, and he was the perfect German weather vane in regard to the forms of implementing it. In 1914, he wrote poetry defending the war. In 1919, he celebrated the advent of the Republic. In 1933, the idol of the socialist masses voted for Hitler. In relation to the glowing view of man held by earlier writers such as Schiller and, in France, Hugo, Hauptmann's late 19th century naturalism is modern. Man, the proudly independent being, has given way to man, the moaning social atom. Hauptmann, however, is not fully representative of the Weimar trend. He is almost an old-fashioned man-glorifier when compared to other, much more influential, literary leader of the country, Thomas Mann. Mann, a disciple of Schopenhauer, Nietzsche, and Wagner, began his career as a German chauvinist authoritarian explicitly opposed to reason and to the values of Western civilization. Gradually, however, he made his peace with the Republic and became a convert to democratic socialism. He went into exile when Hitler took power. The essence of the Republican man's approach to philosophy and to art is eloquently revealed in The Magic Mountain, the major philosophical novel to come out of Weimar Germany. According to one observer, the book published in 1924 has important symptomatic meaning for Weimar. According to another, it may justly be called the saga of the Weimar Republic. These statements are true, though in a different sense than their authors intended. The Magic Mountain is an important symptom of a uniquely 20th century condition. Set in a TB sanitarium, tuberculosis, in the Alps, during the period just before World War I, the novel details 7 years' worth of the inner experiences, the thoughts, feelings, memories, sensations, of Hans Castorp, a tubercular engineer presented as a simple, average youth who wishes to discover the meaning of life. Hans Castorp is an average youth as such might be conceived by Schopenhauer in a necrophiliac mood. There is nothing distinctive about Castorp except a penchant for lengthy abstract discussions and a hypnotic fascination with suffering, disease, and death. His eyes, for instance, glitter with excitement when he hears the coughing of a tubercular patient. I insist, he says early in the novel, that a dying man is above any chap that is going about and laughing and earning his living and eating his 3 meals a day. The major event in Castorp's life at the sanitarium consists in his falling in love with a young woman, Claudia, who attracts him for a number of reasons, among them the fact that she is diseased, that her eyes and voice remind Castorp of a boy to whom he had been attracted years earlier in school, and that she slams doors and acts as intimately bound up with her very being as its state of disease, as time is bound up with the motion of bodies in space. After much hesitation and soul-searching, Castorp declares his love to Claudia in pages of untranslated French. He explains to her that speaking in French prevents his statements from being fully real to him, thus permitting his declaration to retain the quality of a mere dream. Nothing comes of his dreamlike avowal. The next day, Claudia departs from the sanitarium. She later returns as the mistress of a diseased old man and then departs again. Castorp is left, however, with his keepsake, his treasure, which he carries about with him and often presses to his lips, an X-ray of her lungs. At the end, Castorp descends from the mountaintop to fight in the war. We are not told his fate. These few events, along with the grab bag of Castorp's random experiences, are scattered across hundreds of pages. They are buried under mountains of obsessively detailed trivia, accounts of the weather, the scenery, the meals, the doctors, the entertainments, the treatment of the various patients, etc., and of similarly detailed conversations and narrative tracks on an assortment of purportedly intellectual subjects, life, nature, physiology, love, art, time, etc. During the conversations, two men, presented as the spokesmen of opposite schools of philosophy, fight to win Castorp's intellectual allegiance. One is the corrosively ugly NAFTA, and that's N-A-P-H-T-A, don't get excited, the leader of death, a passionate, virtually maniacal champion of pain, illness, sacrifice, religious mysticism, the Inquisition, and the dictatorship of the proletariat. The other, presented as the defender of life, health, science, man, happiness, and liberal republicanism, is the free thinker Settembrini. It has often been said that Settembrini dramatizes man's sympathy for the Republic, and that his character, more than any other in the literature of the period, represents the best of the German Republican spirit. Settembrini is described by Mann as having the curling mustache, shabby dress, and general appearance of an Italian organ grinder, the intellectual manner of a posturing windbag, and the occupational interests of an unworldly simpleton to alleviate human suffering, misery. Ergo, he is working on an encyclopedia of suffering. Jeez. A self-proclaimed champion of human dignity, Settembrini interrupts a recitation from Latin verse to smile at and ogle, most killingly, a passing village girl whom he succeeds in embarrassing. An avowed champion of human brotherhood, he has one dominant emotion, mockery. He loves to laugh at the foibles, real or imagined, of others, a practice he defends by warmly endorsing malice, which is, he says, reason's keenest dart against the powers of darkness and ugliness. An avowed champion of this world, he admires the great Plotinus for having been ashamed to have a body, and delivers several tirades against physical nature, which he calls a stupid and evil power because of its ability to frustrate the intellect, an ability allegedly evidenced in such phenomena as disease and earthquakes. An avowed champion of peace and freedom, he urges Castorp at the novel's end quote, go then to the war. It is your blood that calls. Go and fight bravely. More than that can no man. End of the quote. Yeah, this muck of contradictions and pretentiousness signifies, in the author's opinion, a definite school of philosophy. Man represents Settembrini stressedly as the man of reason and the representative of the era of enlightenment. The contest between NAFTA and Settembrini for Castorp's soul is resolved not by their interminable arguments or by any existential event, but by a dream which Castorp chances to have involving an idyllic community of beautiful youths, supposed to represent life, and a temple in which bloody witches dismember a child with their bare hands, and that represents death. With no explanations offered, Castorp suddenly intuits the answer to his dilemmas. The unrestricted death worship, he decides, is wrong, and so is unrestricted life worship. The truth is in the middle of the road, a golden mean, as it were, between NAFTA and Settembrini, between recklessness and reason, between mystic community and windy individualism. Man, Castorp thinks, is master of contradictions. They exist through him, and so he is grander than they. Grander than death, too grand for it. Grander than life, too grand for it. The recklessness of death, he decides, is inherent in life, but one must award sovereignty in one's thoughts and actions to life, so long as one always remembers to keep faith with death in one's heart. Settembrini, he decides, is too rational. It is love and not reason that is stronger than death. Only love, not reason, gives sweet thoughts. As the caliber of these statements indicates, man, despite the abundance of abstract talk in the book, does not take ideas seriously. In the sequence of Peter Peepercorn, he all but says so openly. Well, once we got peppercorn and peppercorn here. What is it, guys? Okay, we're going to go with peppercorn. It's a typo in the book, I swear. Peppercorn is an old Dutchman described as self-indulgent, non-intellectual, and almost completely inarticulate. It is, he tells Castorp, our sacred duty to feel. For feeling, young man, is godlike. This incoherent creature is presented by man as a stammering, often farcical figure, and at the same time as a majestic presence who wins Castorp's admiration, completely overshadowing pedagogues like NAFTA and Settembrini, because he has a power transcending the realm of the great confusion, that is, intellectual debates. Somehow or other, Castorp tells Settembrini, he has the right to laugh at us all. He is, Castorp concludes, an example of the mystery of personality, something above either cleverness or stupidity. Thomas Mann, the major philosophical novelist of Weimar Germany, is no thinker. The out-of-focus flow of non-events in the book is matched only by the similar flow of non-thoughts, that is, of pseudo-generalities purporting to have cosmic significance and amounting only to a high school bull session with delusions of grandeur. Ooh, Leonard, tell us what you really think. The key to the meaning of the Magic Mountain is that it has no meaning. It commits itself to nothing, neither idea nor value. Man's method is to present his characters, however scientific or maniacal or depraved or pedestrian, with a tolerant detachment overlaid with a furtive mockery. The method is not open satire, but a genteel irony, a timid, well-mannered sneer directed at man, at aspiration, at ideas, any ideas, including even the idea that ideas are useless. Beneath the surface, beneath the murky half-hints, the numbing details, the indecipherable symbols which posturing literati have a field day pretending to decode, the book is a vacuum which says nothing and stands for nothing. Except by implication, implicit in its approach and style, in its well-bred decadence, its sly flirtation with death and disease, its ironic cynicism, its logaric emptiness, its weary, muted disdain for all viewpoints is a viewpoint broadcast to the book's readers, the futility of man, of human effort, of human intelligence. To a country and in a decade swept by hysteria, perishing from uncertainty, torn by political crisis, financial collapse, violence in the streets, and terror of the future, to that country in that decade, its leading philosophical novelist offered as his contribution to sanity and freedom the smiling assurance that there are no answers, no absolutes, no values, no hope. The message reached its audience. The book was a literary sensation, selling tens of thousands of copies in its first year alone. Thomas Mann, says Lecœur, was one of the main pillars of the Republic. If so, anyone could bring the structure crashing down with a single boot. There are other modern writers in Weimar Germany, each in his own way indicative of the period's trend. The works of this group, which generally reflect the influence of Marx or Freud or James Joyce, are characteristically plotless and structureless. The more avant-garde authors, prominent among the expressionists in the theater, feature grotesque juxtapositions of deliberately unintelligible events. Typically, however, the Weimar moderns, like Thomas Mann, simply discard stories as such. serious literature these writers held must transcend materialism. Its proper subject is not man in action, not man using his mind to pursue values in the world, but man's introspective life, his soul, his feelings, particularly his fears, his doubts, his alienation, his inner helplessness. As in the plastic arts, observes Myers, German literary naturalism does not hold its form very long, but soon pours over into the province of symbolism, in which the author stresses mood, states of soul, and other kinds of feeling wherein intellect as such plays a relatively minor role. Another example of this development is the leading poet of the period, Rainer Maria Rilke, a Christian mystic widely admired by conservatives and modernists alike. It could also be pronounced Rilke, I assume, and I'm not looking. The conservatives, such as the rightist youth groups, praised Rilke, or Rilke, as a unique figure who had conquered and discredited the intellectuality that had dominated the West for a millennium. The modernists at times went even further. The novelist Stefan Zweig, for instance, extolled Rilke's later, virtually unintelligible, work as a form of communion not with human beings but with the other, with the beyond of things and feelings. Whatever that means, man. Still another such communer, a leading writer of the time, was Hermann Hesse, later a favorite of New Left college students in America, whose novels shrug off the external world, burrow into the subconsciousness as viewed through the lens of such theories as Jungian analysis, and reveal the message of salvation through Indian mysticism. As to the state of man cut off from intellect, reduced to mood and Jung and the beyond, Franz Kafka, little known in Germany during his lifetime, was presenting it eloquently. He too is immortalizing the spirit of Weimar by offering nightmare projections of nameless ciphers paralyzed by a sinister, unknowable reality. On the whole, the academic institutions, strongholds of Prussianism and tradition, were not part of Weimar culture. Many influential theorists in the humanities and the sciences, however, were part of it. Although some of these men taught in German universities, most were associated with private groups or institutes, or worked in nearby Switzerland or Austria. In academic philosophy, amid a variety of routine movements unknown to the public, one development stands out as both self-consciously new and fairly popular, especially among college students, the existentialism of Martin Heidegger, whose main work, Sein und Zeit, appeared in 1927. Existence, Heidegger declared to his enthusiastic following, is unintelligible, reason is invalid, and man is a helpless Dasein. He is a creature engulfed by das Nichts, nothingness, in the terror of the supreme fact of his life, death endowed by nature to angst, care, estrangement, futility. The novelty of this viewpoint lies primarily not in its content. Heidegger traces his root premises back to Kant, but in its blatancy and form, or rather formlessness. Contrary to the major line of 19th century German philosophers, Heidegger does not attempt to offer an objective defense of his ideas. He rejects the traditional demand for logical argument, definition, integration, system building. As a result, his works, brimming with disdain for the external world and with unintelligible passages, have been praised by admirers in the intellectual counterpart of modern painting. Heidegger, it is sometimes said, exemplifies non-representational thinking. As to human action, according to Heidegger, it must be unreasoned, feeling dictated, willful. On May 27, 1933, he practiced this idea on a grand scale. In a formal, voluntary proclamation, he declared to the country that the age of science and of academic freedom was over, and that hereafter it was the duty of intellectuals to think in the service of the Nazi state. Heidegger's philosophy dispensed with God and religion. Many Weimar modernists, however, sought to preserve religious feeling by reconceiving it in an appropriately contemporary terms. To define the latter was a special task of the period's avant-garde theologians, among them Karl Barth, Emil Brunner, Paul Tillich, and Martin Buber. I hate these names. God, these men declared, cannot be reached by outdated 19th century method, that is, by an attempt at the natural or scientific theology. God, said Barth, is wholly other. He is discontinuous with nature, unknowable to the human intellect, alien to human morality. To know God or acquire true virtue, therefore, man must abandon thought and humbly await the ineffable. On his own, without the benefit of mystical grace, these innovators stressed, man is lost, helpless, wretched. He is tormented by guilt and disfigured by sin, above all by sin of pride. The theological problem, writes Brunner, is to deliver modern man from the illegitimate self-sufficiency of reason and the spirit of autonomy. An avant-garde religion, in short, consists in ditching one's mind, prostrating oneself in the muck, and screaming for mercy. Sounds like the audience for hip-hop. This synthesis of existentialism and the Dark Ages, which soon ruled progressive theology everywhere, did not teach the German public at the time. Sorry, that did not reach the German public at the time. Its less academic equivalents, however, reflecting the same basic cause and the same spirit, did reach the public. Weimar Germany was awash with mystic and occult crazes of every kind, including medieval revivals, Orientalist sects, anthroposophy, theosophy, etc. It was also awash with the social concomitants of such crazes. Certain cultural parallels between Weimar Germany and America in 1970 are almost uncanny, observes Lacker. And this is a quote from him. The phenomenal revival of astrology and various quasi-religious cults, the great acclaim given to prophets of doom, the success of highly marketable Weltschmerz in literature and philosophy, the spread of pornography and the use of drugs, the appearance of charlatans of every possible description, and the enthusiastic audiences welcoming men, all these are common to both periods. There were also movements which purported to speak to the Germans, and later the Americans, in the name of science. The most widely known, fiercely denounced both by traditionalists and by communists, was a movement whose world capital in the 20s was Berlin, the psychoanalysis of Sigmund Freud. Freud's students or admirers in Germany at the time included, among many others of similar prominence today, Karen Horney, Otto Fenichel, Erich Fromm, Herbert Marcuse, Erich Erikson, and William Reich. In 1922, before a rapt Berlin audience, Freud introduced the theory which many of his followers regarded as the intellectual discovery of their era, his tripartite analysis of the human personality. According to this theory, the prime mover in human nature is an unperceivable entity with a will and purpose of its own. The unconscious, which is basically an id, that is, a contradictory, amoral it, seething with innate, bestial, primevally inherited, imperiously insistent cravings or instincts. In deadly combat with this element is man's conscious or superego, which consists essentially not of reasoned moral convictions, but of primitive, illogical, largely unconscious taboos or categorical imperatives representing the mores of the child's parents and ultimately of society, whose random injunctions every individual unquestioningly introjects and cowers before. Caught in the middle between these forces, between a psychopathic hippie screaming, "Satisfaction now," and a jungle chieftain intoning, "Tribal obedience," sentenced by nature to ineradicable conflict, guilt, anxiety, and neurosis is man. That is, man's mind, his reason or ego, the faculty which is able to grasp reality and which exists primarily to mediate between the clashing demands of the psyche's two irrational masters. As this theory makes eloquently clear, Freud's view of reason is fundamentally Kantian. Both men hold that human thought is ultimately governed not by a man's awareness of external fact, but by inner mental elements independent of such fact. Both see the basic task of the mind not as perception, but as creation, the creation of a subjective world in compliance with the requirements of innate or introjected mental structures. Whereas Kant, however, draws on the concepts of 18th century Enlightenment philosophy to define his categories and strives to defend them as inherent in pure reason, Freud derives his key structures from 19th century Romanticist philosophy and flaunts their anti-rational character. The theory of the id is the voluntarist insistence on the primacy of will. The theory of the superego is the Hegelian insistence that the individual, including his moral ideas, is a mere fragment of the group. In regard to method, the basic novelty of this psychological variant of the Kantian viewpoint lies in the Freudians' claim that their theories are a product not of a priori philosophizing, but of scientific investigation based on clinical data. Judging by their methodological practice, scientific investigation for the Freudians consists in leaping from random observations to sweeping constructs devoid of evidential justification, rational or empirical, and then in declaring that these constructs are compatible with any factual data of any kind and are therefore irrefutable. For example, if one finds no sign of an Oedipus complex, it has, one is told, been repressed. If one finds evidence contradicting it, there has been a reaction formation, etc. This unprecedented approach to scientific inquiry is a corollary of the basic Freudian theory. If man's mind, as Freud says, is ruled by forces indifferent to facts, forces which are unmoved by logical rebuttal, and unaffected, though reality refutes them, then science in the 19th century sense, science as the rigorous logical pursuit of objective knowledge, is impossible. The new science, like the new philosophy, the new theology, the new art, becomes instead a vehicle of the willful, the arbitrary, the subjective. Kant had made the attack on the self, the essence of virtue. Here too, Freud is a follower. The real root of the outrage his own doctrines provoked, Freud says with a certain pride, is their assault on the self-love of humanity. Whatever the wounds that men have suffered from earlier scientific theories, he explains, the blow of psychoanalysis is probably the most wounding. The blow, he states, is the idea that man is not supreme in his soul, that the ego is not master in its own house. These formulations, while eloquent, are too generalized to capture fully the essence of Freud's wound. Freud did not originate determinism, or irrationalism, or collectivism, or the theory of original sin, or cynicism, or pessimism, or even the idea of the unconscious. What he did originate, relying on all these theories, is a specific, and in its details, unprecedented view of man. Freud offers to the world not man the dutiful, decorous non-perceiver, as in Kant, not man the defeated plaything of grand-scale forces such as a malevolent reality or God or society or a tragic flaw, as in the works of countless traditional cynics and pessimists, but man the defeated plaything of the gutter. Man the smutty pawn shaped by sexual aberrations and toilet training, itching to rape his mother, castrate his father, hoard his excrement, man the sordid cheat who pursues science because he is a frustrated voyeur, God, what a statement that is, practices surgery because he is a sublimating sadist, and creates the David because he craves secretly to mold his own feces. Man as a loathsomely small or dure-strewn pervert, such is the sort of wound that Freud inflicted on the being who had once been defined in a radiantly different age as the rational animal. The expression beyond freedom and dignity, it has been said, names a distinctly modern view of man. By this standard, Freud is a preeminent modern. In relation to him, B.F. Skinner and the behaviorists, and Heidegger and Barth and even Thomas Mann are pikers. In virtually every important scholarly field, German culture during the 20s was pervaded by new developments, some explicitly disowning the mechanistic bourgeois 19th century, others wearing a fig leaf of traditional elements, some hailed as anti-science, others as new science, some widely known and popular, others academic and cloistered. The educated German could hear the voice of the Weimar vision everywhere. He could hear it from intellectual leaders such as Max Weber, one of the major influences in the popular young field of sociology, who declared that an objective social science can have nothing to do with ethics or with absolutes of any kind, but must be relativist, tentative, value-free. There were young innovators in the sociology of knowledge, such as Karl Mannheim, who held that man is moved by class interest and therefore is incapable of objective thought, except for a special elite, the intelligentsia, who transcend this law of human nature. There was the prominent sociologist, Werner Sombart, a one-time Marxist who, deciding that values are inescapable and objectivity irrelevant, proceeded to belly flop into the waiting arms of mysticism, German socialism, and the Führer. Political scientists such as Carl Schmitt and Robert Michaels laid bare the irrational basis of political behavior to such an extent as to destroy any possibility for orderly democratic political organization. The progressive educators were telling German parents that the communication of knowledge is harmful to the process of education, which should focus instead on the child's feelings, fantasies, and social adjustment. The highly reputable art historians associated with the Warburg Institute were pioneering the introduction of new topics into their field, such as the study of magic, astrology, and the occult. The erudite theatricians and social commentators of the Frankfurt Institute were formulating a new Western Marxism, melding the socialism of Marx with the idealism of Hegel and the sex theories of Freud. That's all the basic food groups right there. The logical positivists of the Vienna Circle, in the name of scientific approach to philosophy, were launching their unprecedented assault against logic, concepts, certainty, metaphysics, ethics, politics, and even philosophy itself. Meanwhile, the younger physicist, typified by Werner Heisenberg, whose uncertainty principle was announced in 1927, were suggesting to the avant-garde that the traditional Newtonian Einsteinian view of a universe fully accessible to man's mind is outdated, inasmuch as the subatomic realm is ruled not by cause and effect, but ultimately by chance, a viewpoint once confined to the age of pre-physics. Even the professional mathematicians, the one-time guardians of the citadel of certainty and of logical consistency, caught the hang of the modern spirit. In 1931, they were apprised of the latest Viennese development in the field, Kurt Gödel's incompleteness theorem, according to which logical consistency, and therefore certainty, is precisely the attribute that no system of mathematicians can ever claim to possess. There are no guarantees that our cherished edifices of logic and mathematics are free of contradiction, explained the New York Times many years later, describing Gödel's awesome achievement, and our daily assumptions to that effect are the mere acts of faith. One American psychologist summarizing Freudian theory in 1933 makes a statement applicable in principle to all of the above and to many similar developments, most of which arose independently of one another and of any Freudian influence. The notion of reason enthroned disappears into myth and the rational man collapses. As to the kind of man who is left after this happens, he was free to contemplate everywhere the embodiments of his kind of soul, not only the modern novels, but the raving soliloquies of the expressionists, the alienated noise of their music, the pig-like snouts of their paintings, the stinking suns of their poems. They were also the semi-expressionist melanges of the avowedly anti-Aristotelian dramatist Bertolt Brecht, who was urging that playwrights destroy the theoretical illusion by such means as intermixing a play's action with the voice of an offstage narrator and having the actor step into and out of their roles. And there was the mass of self-conscious ugly images that had swarmed into Germany from abroad, spawned by trends such as cubism and surrealism and Italian futurism. Logic, order, truth, reason, we can sign them all to the oblivion of death, said one surrealist manifesto. We must cultivate the hatred of intelligence, said the leader of the futurists, Filippo Marinetti, an artist hailed by Mussolini as the John the Baptist of fascism. Jeez. There were also the models for many of the above, the ancient models that the new artists, eager for guidance in the new methods, unearthed and strove to emulate. The artists turned not only to the medievals, but also to African primitivism, Bushman paintings, Asian mystery religions, Polynesian witchcraft, the atavistic clairvoyance heralded by Rudolf Steiner, and the artifacts of patients locked up in lunatic asylums. Such is the kind of art and the kind of cultural philosophical trend which, in a spectrum of varying forms and degrees, the new rebels created and spread throughout the country once they got their foot in the door. And that'll end this part. And I tell you, that's really heavy going. And it does, I mean, listening to this, reading this, and reciting this, I mean, it just leaves you, I don't know, with this burdensome feeling. And I think that's probably what Peikoff, you know, wanted to have happen. I guess this is the way he looked at it, and he drove us, in a sense, with his writing, to feel what he feels, I assume. And to that end, we've gone through this part. A little bit more of that, and then we're going to get just to the high points of the rest of this book, in which he does draw the ominous parallels between what took place in the Weimar Republic on its way to Hitler's Nazi Germany. And we'll continue that next time around. Thanks for listening.